Welcome back. You're listening to the Medical School Research Podcast. This is Parker and James, and in today's episode, we'll be interviewing Cullen Lilly, a fourth-year medical student at Loyola University Chicago Stritch School of Medicine, currently applying to pathology residencies. Cullen is the co-founder of Path Elective and the creator of MicromedEd. He has been involved in various forms of research, from conducting research at the CDC to bioethics. Thanks for tuning in. Let's get started.
To start us off, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background? What undergrad did you go to?
So I started at Loyola University New Orleans for my undergrad. I did a Bachelor of Music and a Bachelor of Science. I studied biology for my Bachelor of Science. I was doing vocal performance for my music major, and then kind of worked on a little bit of research during that, and then afterwards got a master's in microbiology, and I worked as a microbiology technician for a little bit, and then I worked at the CDC as a microbiologist.
Okay. Are you interested in any particular specialty area of medicine?
Yeah. Kind of going into medical school, I was interested in laboratory medicine because I had a little bit of a background in it, but kind of wanted to make sure I was going into the right thing. So I wanted to kind of explore everything, but, you know, at the end of the day, I still came back to pathology. It's probably the best field in medicine, if I do say so myself, but obviously everyone's going to say that about their specialty. But yeah, that's what I've kind of decided to pursue, is pathology and laboratory medicine.
So this podcast is focused on helping current and prospective medical students explore their research. So let's dig in a little bit to your research journey. What was your first experience in research?
Yeah, I guess it started kind of, like I said, back in undergrad. I was in a molecular genetics course, and my professor was saying that she was working on a project that needed some people. So I volunteered for that and then ended up working in her lab for a summer and got a lot of exposure, to quantitative PCR and cell culture and immunohistochemistry and all those really cool lab techniques. And that really kind of got my interests in the cell and molecular biology realm kind of kicking. And so much so that I actually almost pursued a PhD because I was so interested in lab-based research. But that's kind of where it all started. And ever since then, just kind of kept picking up projects as I went along.
You know, it's interesting that you got involved in lab-based research and really liked it, because most pre-medical students tend to get involved with wet lab research, but most students tend to not like it. They tend to have negative experiences. So I'm wondering, is there a defining quality to, people that tend to like the wet lab a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, I totally feel that. I get that from a lot of people, especially pre-medical students interested in going into medical school. They're like, do I have to do lab research? Can I do anything else? Because I really just don't like it. I mean, for me, I think that it's always something that if you're in a science major in undergrad, you should try lab-based research. The reason I say that is because there's so many things you can do with a Bachelor of Science, and a lot of them will be kind of lab-based. So you might as well see if it's something for you. For some people, it isn't. But honestly, I feel like it's less a personality thing and more the people you work with. That's a huge thing. If you have a mentor that's serving as your research advisor, that's a huge difference than just somebody that's there to sign off on things whenever you kind of submit them. So, it can be challenging in the research realm. It can be really challenging in the lab, because there's plenty of research advisors that aren't really going to be there for you in terms of mentoring your career. But if you find someone that does end up mentoring you and really trying to champion you as a person going into medicine or somebody going into laboratory science, that really does make a huge difference. And that can also completely change how you think about the field. So, take it or leave it, but that's also kind of what makes people either stick with a PhD or do something else. So, it's a lot about the people.
It's a great point. How did that experience before medical school in the wet lab prepare you for future research as a medical student?
Yeah. Well, I used a lot of my techniques that I learned in my pre-medical years doing research. So all of the lab-based techniques I used in my professional career after undergrad. So when I was working in the microbiology lab, I was doing PCR, I was doing sequencing. I kind of worked a little bit more in the microbiology realm. So I was doing more of kind of the microscopy techniques, more of culture and isolation, but I used a lot of my molecular techniques, and so much so I ended up getting a molecular diagnostic technologist certification because I was so involved with the molecular techniques. That kind of led me into getting involved at the CDC, where they're kind of moving almost all the way into molecular diagnostics for all of their research and all of their diagnostics. And so all of those techniques I used again. And so there, they actually do whole genome sequencing. So I learned a little bit of kind of more advanced techniques than I was learning before, but that also led a little bit more into kind of computational methods. So that ended up being a little bit more advantageous because there's so much research using computational methods nowadays.
Could you tell us a little bit more about that certificate program? So for anyone interested, how can they go about obtaining a certificate, and like what type of doors can that open for someone that does do that?
Yeah. Well, there's actually a ton of certificates. It's kind of cool, but if you have kind of a biology background and you kind of have worked in a lab and you might be interested in kind of more clinical based laboratory studies, you can get certifications with the American Society for Clinical Pathology, ASCP, or the American Association of Bioanalysts, which is what I got my first certificate through and then later got an ASCP certification. But those do open doors for, if you like being in the lab, they open doors for you being able to participate in patient care through the laboratory. So there's a whole realm of these careers out there that are in the medical laboratory science field. And so that's another way of getting into medicine, still maintaining kind of a research type lens and being really kind of like a basic science life scientist in a hospital. So that's still kind of a way to keep involved with all of those things. And that's medical laboratory science. So that's always a field that you could consider if you're interested in lab, if you're interested in medicine, but you don't know if you want to go to medical school. That's another thing. For me, it helped because it helped me get into kind of some more advanced techniques and helped me get into the CDC at the end of the day. So that's kind of where it led me.
But I know how hard it is to get into the CDC. Everyone wants to work at the CDC, especially if you're in Atlanta. So could you tell us a little bit about, you know, avenues to get into the CDC?
It is probably one of the more difficult places to get into. And I would say really any government facility is going to be difficult to get into. FDA, CDC, they're all pretty similar in terms of rigor, in terms of like getting into them. But a lot of them share similar avenues. So as a recent graduate, you could work on a fellowship program where you are doing like laboratory fellowship there. There's also some recruiting agencies. So I was recruited through IHRC. And so they have kind of some recruiting where they get people in. And so that's another avenue. And there's plenty of other recruiting agencies. That's just kind of the only one that I can think of because it was relevant to me. But the ORISE, O-R-I-S-E, is a fellowship that you can use to get into FDA or CDC or some other, I think NIH also has some as well. So that's another avenue if you wanted to get in.
Okay. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's really good tangible advice. What was your first research experience in medical school?
My first research experience was right before the COVID pandemic. I was working on Candida auris, and I was kind of looking if there was different ways that we could isolate it in the clinical realm, because we were having a lot of Candida auris infections in the hospital, and it was causing a fair amount of morbidity and mortality amongst people who were infected. So the hospital had a vested interest in trying to figure out which patients were Candida auris carriers and which ones were not. So they had previously been using some like axillary swabs and groin swabs. And so we just wanted to see if the nares swab that you used for Staph aureus also had possible Candida auris detection. So that was kind of what I was working on at the beginning. It was a little bit of a smaller project. It was going to turn into a larger summer project, but of course then the COVID pandemic kind of messed everything up there, kind of squashed all microbiology research for a little bit because everyone was working on COVID. So take it or leave it, but then that actually ended up leading into kind of building Path Elective, which is what I ended up working on for most of my medical school career.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about how you identified the PI for this project?
Yeah. For the Canada RS project, I was actually connected with the faculty mentor for pathology at Loyola, Dr. Mirza. And he was amazing. And he saw that I had interest in microbiology. I had a background in microbiology, and he was really wanted to connect me with someone that could use that experience and kind of elevate that and bring some academic output, which in our terms is usually publications or posters. And so he introduced me to the microbiology director, and that's kind of where that took off. So, you know, it wasn't a direct introduction to the microbiology director. It was actually kind of a side introduction through someone else. And it ended up being a really great connection.
A big hurdle for a lot of basic science research is getting the funding. So I'm curious if that was a challenge that you experienced and how you overcame that challenge of finding funding.
Yeah. At Loyola, we do have the summer research honors program where you can apply for NIH funding. And I did apply for that, and I received the notification that I got it. Of course, a week later, everything got closed after we found out about COVID. But in our pathology department, it's really fortunate. We're fortunate enough to have funding for each of the professors. So each of the associate or assistant professors, as well as the full-time professors, they all have their own research funding, and they can use that in different forms, and they can use it for whatever they want, and as long as it's kind of going to produce some kind of academic output. And so even though I didn't have funding through the NIH grant, we had funding through the different people that I was working with. So that was a side way to get a little bit of funding. But of course, if you want to get more funding, there's other grants, which we ended up applying for a little bit later. So the Association of Pathology Chairs offered a grant for undergraduate medical education research. And so I applied for that. And later I got that for my pathelective research.
So it takes a lot of skill to work in these labs. And of course, you had your pre-medical school experiences that really prepared you. But I suppose for the student that has never worked in a basic science lab before, are there, you know, any skills they need to have before they get into working in a micro lab?
Yeah. It's tough to say. I feel like if you're talking about kind of just coming from undergrad and going to go work in a microbiology lab, a lot of the stuff can be taught. And so if you're, you know, going in to get a master's or going to work in a research lab somewhere, like a lot of those skills can be taught. If you are coming into medical school and you want to work in a microbiology lab, there's a lot of things that you can do without even being in the lab. I think coming from basic science realm, I was a little bit more single-minded in terms of what a research project meant. But then going into academic medicine, you start to realize anything can be a research project. And it kind of opens your eyes into like, really, you could make everything into some kind of academic output, like a publication or a poster or some kind of presentation. And with that, you start to realize that the opportunities are endless, right? Like you can do chart review for a project, and that could be a paper. You could just analyze things that have been going on in the lab. You don't even have to go into the lab, but you can analyze the things that are coming off of the machines and seeing if there's ways that we can improve it. You can look at trends and reporting. I'm just thinking about pathology stuff here, but that's kind of the things that you can work on in the pathology realm. But then in the clinical realm, case reports, those are huge. Looking at interesting patient presentations, or looking back at charts and seeing if different treatments were effective, or there's so many different things you can do, and it actually makes it a lot easier to participate in research the further you go along, because you start to realize your expertise is valuable as a medical student and then later on as a resident.
Could you talk a little bit about the research projects you're working on right now?
Yeah. As I've kind of alluded to from the beginning, after the COVID-19 pandemic shut down all of the basic research, I started to work on some more medical education research. So I built a website with Dr. Mirza at Loyola, and we kind of put together all of these different courses with all these pathologists around the country. And we had pre and post quizzes, and those pre and post quizzes served as the kind of way that we analyzed how effective the course website was. So that was kind of the introduction to education research that I got. Later on, we started to realize that there was a lot of students taking these courses. So I actually had a lot of data, which was great for research. Also started to get into a little bit of website research and website user design. Lots of opportunities there, which I didn't even know about. And that's kind of one of the things that's been longitudinally working throughout my medical school career. But other things that I'm working on, retrospective chart reviews for different diseases like inflammatory bowel disease, looking at different histologic characteristics in these patients' biopsies, seeing if they portend different prognostic indicators later on in disease. Also looking at some different scoring for squamous cell carcinoma and head and neck cancers. I looked at a few different pathologies in medical renal pathology and how they relate to transplant medicine. So, you know, in pathology, the opportunities for research are endless. So you can kind of just keep going, and everyone has a project that they're interested in. And so it became pretty easy to pick up some things as I went along.
You know, you have experiences everywhere, like you mentioned, you know, and even in ethics, medical education, basic sciences. I'm just curious, which ones have taken the most time from you?
Yeah. Well, I would have to say building a website was probably the hardest thing I've done. I have no experience in building a website. So that was a whole thing of teaching myself how to do that and then building a website. But in terms of like the analysis, that didn't actually take that long. That was a pretty solid project in terms of turnaround. Some of the other ones that have taken a while have been ones that you have to do a lot of chart review on. So some inflammatory bowel disease research that I was working on is taken a while to get through. And believe it or not, I think the ethics research that I partake in, that can take a while. You know, thinking about thinking is really difficult. So when you're starting to think about how to change, you know, our healthcare system, or what are some ways to improve, patient communication with, and pertains to like the pathology report, that stuff can take a lot of time. It takes a lot of reading and a lot of writing. So, you know, it kind of depends on what the project is. It's most of the time, the time consuming part is going to be in the data collection. So all that stuff with like chart review and analyzing slides, that usually takes a while.
I'm curious to know, in your opinion, what type of projects are the quickest to finish? Because I've seen this, many students don't know what they want to do until they get into clerkships. And then let's say it's a more competitive specialty and they know they should probably get research in that field. They're looking for projects that, you know, don't take a couple of years to finish. So, you know, in your experience, which ones have been the quickest?
Yeah, I would say obviously anything that's an abstract is going to be pretty quick. So abstracts are always pretty easy to get out there. If you're trying to get a publication, case reports are usually the quickest, and then probably followed closely behind by like a case series. I tend to like those because they're interesting as a learner to like actually think about these complicated cases and why they ended up the way they ended up and how we could have done better, how we really couldn't have done any better. So those are always interesting. However, a big caveat to case reports is that, you know, a lot of times they're very hard to get accepted. So if you are spending an exorbitant amount of time on a case report, you probably shouldn't. You know, spend whatever time you need to get it out there. And then if it gets accepted, it gets accepted. If it doesn't, you know, move on. It's not something that you should spend a ton of time on, but it usually does help get some kind of output when you're thinking about trying to get your publications up or however you kind of want to get along that. But, you know, something to recognize is that when you're finishing your ERAS and you're applying to residency, when you're applying for match and all that stuff, you know, when you're in your application, the abstracts and publications, they all count kind of the same. You know, when you are in the interview, obviously a publication is going to be weighted more heavily than an abstract, but on the page, they're counted the same. So you know, it's tough to get publications out there, but you can kind of get your foot in the door by getting some abstracts out.
All right, Colin, I'm going to take over a bit for the second half of this interview. So my first question for you is one that I love to ask our guests. It's, while participating in so many different research projects throughout your career thus far, was there a significant opportunity cost for you to dedicate so much time specifically to research?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely, there are some times where, you know, I was spending more time on research than I maybe should have. I might have gotten a little bit of a lower grade here or there. And as a whole, you kind of do have to weigh out which one you want to participate in. As a whole, you're going to medical school to become a doctor, so you should learn what you are going to need to learn for your patients. That's the number one goal. I had a really, really great mentor who always said, if I'm pushing you too hard, just let me know and I'll back off. And so that was really great because I always knew that if I was a little bit too overwhelmed, I could always just say, hey, I need some time. I need to focus on my schoolwork. With all that said, you know, if I'm coming near the end of the year and I really wanted to go to this research conference and I have to miss a couple of days of a clerkship, I'm like, you know, this is my career and this is like the exact people I need to be in front of. So for me, like that was worth my time to go to a conference like USCAP or ASCP or something like that. Like that was worth my time. But you know, other things where if you're on your rotation and someone's like, hey, could you work on this case report and you have your shelf coming up, I would probably focus on the shelf, you know, and not work on the case report until maybe after. There are some times where you're going to realize you overcalculated what you needed for one thing or undercalculated what you need for another. And that's a learning experience as you go along. I think that's the benefit of starting research when you're an undergrad is you start to realize how much time certain things take. You start to get quicker at writing, you start to get quicker at analyzing data, and you can kind of actually calculate what you need. But it's all a learning process and none of us are doing it perfectly. And you kind of have to recognize that.
Do you have any other advice for students who might feel overwhelmed at the prospect of just getting involved in research while they have to pursue other things such as shadowing and academic responsibilities, various extracurricular activities? In other words, how do you find balance between your academics, research, and your personal duties?
Yeah. You know, this is something that I think people are super, super stressed about at the very beginning of medical school. I would say probably at Loyola, it's very similar. We have our STAR summer research application due near the end of the first semester, and you have to find that person who's going to help you with your summer research. And that's tough. That's really hard to do right off the bat. I would say that it is probably paramount, if not like the most important thing that in medical school is to figure out how you're learning and how you're going to learn all this material. The brain changes as we get older and we all learn differently. And it's what you did in undergrad probably won't work for medical school. There's just so much information. So for me, I spent a fair amount of time learning how I learn and didn't really even think about research until probably halfway through my first semester, and then brought it up to my faculty advisor. And I was like, hey, I am really interested in research. I'm also interested in pathology. Is there something that like you think I might be a good fit for? And honestly, at the beginning, I had no idea what the whole field of pathology was. So I had no idea that you could be doing research on blood cancers and skin cancers and GI cancers and all these different autoimmune conditions. Like I just had no idea. I was just a first year. I was basically just an undergrad, if I think back to it. But with all of that said, you have to be comfortable with yourself and you have to be comfortable with where you are. If you're overwhelmed, you won't be able to learn. And so you have to find balance in your life. For me, I like to write. And so for that part of research, it's usually the part that other people don't like. People usually don't like to write. So for me, I thought that kind of writing while I was watching a TV show was fine. For some people, that would be way too much. So if that's not something for you, that's not something for you. It's research is not 100% required in medical school, but it's always recommended. And it's becoming more important as, you know, step one has become pass fail. And so now we really just kind of have step two. But, you know, you can also partake, like I said before, in a lot of research projects that might be pretty small. You know, like getting an abstract in here or there could look really good. So, you know, I wouldn't get yourself overwhelmed with partaking in a ton of research, because at the end of the day, you're here for taking care of patients, and you won't be able to do that if you miss out on those opportunities.
So if we think a little bit about how this might play out for prospective medical students that are confused on where to start with research, do you have any tips on how to do that?
Yeah. So like I said, kind of a while ago, with basic science research, it's almost more about the people than it is about the content. So if you have a professor that you have absolutely adored, or that have been a great help to you in your career, or have sponsored you in a certain way, and they've put you kind of above others and giving opportunities or something like that, anything that you think that someone, one of your professors has kind of given you those opportunities, or you see that they would be a really good mentor, ask about research. You know, even if it's something that you might think would not pertain to medicine at all, like you're a pre-med and you're like, I don't want to do algae research, but I absolutely love this professor, you know, reach out to them and see if they have anything. Because really, what you're going to gain from research is not understanding the biochemical mechanisms of algae. I mean, I was working on rheumatoid arthritis research in undergrad, and I can't tell you all of the different immunologic like mechanisms behind RA, but I can tell you that I learned a lot about the different laboratory methods, and I also learned a lot about reading and writing. And I know it sounds very elementary, but learning how to read a research article relatively quickly and well will suit you way better than some other things. So, you know, it's all about the people. And if you find someone that you really do look up to, ask them about research. And, you know, they might say that they don't have anything, and that's fine. But they also might say, like my research or like my faculty advisor said, they might have someone else that they kind of thought of. And so they could introduce you to someone.
So it kind of sounds like what you're saying is to get started in research prior to medical school, it'd be great to just express your interest, kind of get connected, and try not to tunnel vision in on something. It's more of just appreciating the process and understanding the basics to get a foundation to kind of like wheel yourself into the research world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You said it way better than I did.
All right. So I'm curious, an aspect of research that we think isn't talked about enough is mentorship. And we understand that mentorship is important in research and academics in general, as you mentioned earlier at the beginning of this interview. And I would love to know more about the role mentorship has played in your research experiences. We already discussed how you found your first mentor. So I'm curious, what advice do you have to others for them to find a good mentor?
It's one of the toughest things, honestly, in academia and academic medicine. I don't think that anyone spends enough time thinking about mentorship. And I especially think that schools don't think enough about it. You know, Loyola does throw a ton of opportunities at us. Luckily, as medical students, they, you know, have all these different opportunities to get matched up with a mentor, but finding a match is difficult. That's probably the hardest part. The thing that I think I didn't think about at the beginning of medical school when I was looking for a mentor was that you don't have to live with that same mentor for the rest of your life. So that one mentor could be with you for a week, and you might say, I really don't like this person. And that's fine. That's totally fine. You know, it's just transparency and communicating and working on just finding the next person. And because, you know, not every person will be a great match. And I've known that. I have in plenty of research projects that I probably don't mesh well with the, you know, research attending or whatever, but it's fine. I work with them and I kind of get the job done, but I have a mentor there who's helped me with my career, who's driven me through kind of everything, all of my questions, all of my career questions, all of my uncertainties or insecurities, they've been there with me. They've walked through it. So, you know, at the end of the day, it really comes down to recognizing when you mesh with someone and when you don't. And you can move on. And you can also have mentors for different things. I could have a research mentor who's mentoring me in academia and trying to advance my research career, getting a postdoc fellowship if I want to do that. And I could also have a mentor that's mentoring me in medical education if I wanted to teach. So, you know, there's mentors for different things. And you just have to kind of figure out where you mesh well and who you work well with.
It seems like having an open mind towards research is a really valuable trait to have. So while we're in the realm of communication, I think it's easy to recognize that communication is a significant aspect of the research process in many different ways. And bringing an idea to a broader audience can help spread your work and give it a greater impact. Now, you have over 4,000 followers on Twitter, and I'm curious if you have any advice for student researchers who want to promote their research and grow their following online and share their work with others.
Yeah, I think social media is just going to play even a bigger role in the future in terms of research. You know, social media has played a role in medical education. It's played a role in research. It's played a role in communication. I don't think there's really been a concerted effort in a ton of fields to make it a part of your brand, to, you know, market your research, to bring your research out to the public and to share different educational topics, if that's what your kind of feature in your social media brand is. The big thing that I would say is just get started with some kind of professional social media. You know, it might be Twitter, it might be TikTok, it might be Instagram, and that's all fine. They're all fine. But just make sure you have some kind of professional presence out there. So that's like the first thing. Second thing is, if you're trying to grow a following, there's been a fair amount of data out there that suggests if you do stuff regularly, you'll gain a following, no matter what you're doing. So for me, I did weekly posts about microbiology topics, and I did that for like a year. That grew my following quite a bit, but then I kind of was like, that's a lot of work, and I wasn't really getting a ton out of it professionally. And I was like, okay, well, I'll take a break from that, and I'll just promote things whenever I can. So I started to get involved with social media committees because I liked social media. And so I was like, well, I can help out with other societies and get involved with social media with them. So, you know, I got involved with the social media committee at American Society for Clinical Pathology. So, you know, you can grow a following. It takes a long time, but you can grow a following no matter what you're doing. You just have to be consistent. And then the other thing is being responsible with social media. That's probably the more challenging part. If you're building a brand, you have to make sure your brand is consistent. And that has to deal with professionalism. It has to deal with kind of what you're sharing. For me, it's kind of difficult because I have pathology and I also have ethics. And so I'm like, do I post stuff about ethics when I'm, you know, mostly have like a pathology following, or do I kind of bring pathology to ethics? That's always kind of difficult. So as of right now, I've kind of just been focusing more on pathology stuff, which is fine. Maybe in the future, I'll build a niche of pathology ethics. I don't know. But, you know, it's all about being consistent, being professional, and promoting what you can, and also promoting others. I think that really shows a lot of humility when you can promote others, other people's works as well, and get them recognized.
Absolutely. And I mean, promoting others, I mean, then perhaps they can promote you and you can build connections that way as well. I think that's a really valuable thing to do.
Absolutely. So, yeah. And I just wanted to throw in a little bit there because I will say almost all of my colleagues that I've developed, or all the colleagues that I've met, or all the colleagues that I've kind of become very close with, have almost all been over Twitter initially. So, you know, social media has been incredible. You know, I've met people from all over the country and I've become friends with them. They've given me advice on, you know, where to apply or what to do when I'm applying. And that's been really helpful. And also I've gotten research collaborators out of it. I've put out messages where I'm like, hey, I want help with this, but I don't have time for it. And people respond. So, you know, it's a possibility to get research collaboration. It's a possibility to share your research, promote others. The possibilities are endless.
So you mentioned earlier that you really enjoy writing, and it's easy to see that you enjoy doing that in multiple different ways, be it writing a Twitter post or writing a research article or just publishing something on MedPage Today. Like, we found an article you wrote called Reimagining the Step 1 Exam Dedicated Study Period. And I'm curious, from conceptualization to publication, could you share some insight into that writing process and how it compares to research-based writing?
Yeah. So I kind of started getting involved with the like news outlets slash like op-ed slash opinion pieces when I was working with my my ethics degree. So I'm also pursuing a master's in ethics. And so the bioethics degree that I'm working on, I have to think a lot. You know, we think about a lot of different dilemmas. We think about some problems that might be arising. And as I think about them, and as I think about issues that are pertinent to my career or to my future career, I just write something. And, you know, I'm currently in kind of a writing course with the master's, and I'm starting to realize there's so many different ways to do this. And I've always just kind of always done it the same way. But what things that I've found that are helpful is just get your ideas out there and don't delete anything. So, you know, get a document started, start writing, and just see what you come up with. Because you might start to realize that you actually have a whole paper there and you just have been thinking about it and you haven't gotten it out. So I'll start writing something, and as I go, I might start organizing it into an outline. So I just start kind of stream of consciousness, writing stuff, and then putting it into different places. And then I'll do like a PubMed review, try to see if there's any literature out there, and then put it together. And a lot of these things, the things that are not necessarily like research based, I'll end up kind of submitting to an opinion piece or an op-ed. And those ones are things that I think are relevant in the moment that don't have enough time to kind of go through like a peer review process. So that one that I was thinking about, the Reimagining the Step 1 Dedicated Period, I was kind of in the moment, like in the next couple months, I think I published that in January. So like in February, March, April, people were going to start their dedicated period. And I wanted to put a little bit of what I had to say out there. And so it's a little bit of a different process. So I write it, and then you submit it to the outlet that you want to give it to. So it's either like Kevin MD or MedPage Today or OpMed on Doximity. There's different ways that you can do this. And then they'll have some feedback, and you can either rewrite or you can edit, and then they'll publish it. And it's usually like a few week turnaround versus, you know, like months of peer review. So that's kind of where I've pieced out where I send things. And I like them because I can get kind of my ethics view on things in some of them. And I can also bring in some pertinent things, like things that are relevant in the moment that I want people to read about.
It sounds like writing has been a really important skill for you to practice continually throughout your career. And what other professional skills have you developed that afford you more meaningful contributions to your collaborative research projects? Are there any skills that you think are particularly useful for being a productive researcher?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, there's so many that I probably haven't even developed, but if you're good at statistics, if you're good at coding, that's a huge benefit. I know a lot of friends that just do statistics for papers and they have like 1,000 papers. I'm not necessarily that kind of person, but if I was going to be one of those, that'd be awesome, right? You'd have a ton of papers, which is really cool. I like writing. And so obviously that was a huge part of research. And I think that if you're interested in research, you should learn how to read and write pretty well, because you'll be reading and writing a lot. The other things that I think are helpful are presenting and developing presentations. If you're working in a lab, you'll get to do that usually about like weekly or monthly if you're doing your lab meetings. But also you get used to that when you're building posters and you're talking to people. I think other things that are helpful in research, I think a good lit review. So if you learn how to do like a mesh search on PubMed, or if you learn how to do a systematic review, that's like really beneficial. Not many people know how to do that. And not many people know how to do a really good literature review. So if you can pull literature and review it pretty quickly, you'll be a rock star. I've used lit review in a lot of my papers. So developing that skill is really helpful. And you can do that for free, right? NCBI, all that stuff is free.
As we wrap up with our last few questions of the interview, is there anything that we haven't already discussed that you'd like to share with our listeners?
A lot of people think that research is all in the lab. And I think that by the end of this, you'll realize it probably isn't, but maybe by other episodes, you'll also kind of realize this. But research can be whatever you make it. And you can make a research project out of anything if you think about it enough beforehand. So if you're developing a new set of lectures for your interest group, you can turn that into a research project. All you have to do is make sure you have an IRB, or if you have data that you need to collect it in a way that is compatible with an IRB, or just write everything down as you go. But anything can be research. And so I wouldn't get too tied down on, I have to get into this lab or I have to get in with this person. If you have a mentor that you're working with on a student interest group, you can make a research project. You just have to put in the work. So, you know, hopefully by the end of this, you'll realize that research isn't super scary. I think the scary thing is just starting it. And once you start it, then you'll realize that everything else is a possibility. You know, anything can happen after that.
That is some fantastic insight. I mean, I 100% agree, especially with the starting it is the scariest part. I have so many projects that I was intimidated to just get it going. But once you get the ball rolling, I mean, it's not smooth sailing, but it's not as turbulent as you might expect. So as an MS4 that's been working on residency applications, and I think you have interviews either ongoing right now or coming up, do you plan to continue your research into residency and beyond? And if so, what types of research do you plan on pursuing? Would it be more wet lab stuff still, or would you be doing more lit reviews, et cetera?
That's a great question. You know, I was actually talking with a program director not too long ago about this. For the rest of medical school, I'm going to be doing research for sure, 100%. I need to wrap up a lot of the things that I've started, and I don't want to disappoint the people that I've kind of committed to. So I'm definitely going to be doing research for the rest of medical school. I think at the beginning of residency, I'll probably take a break for a little bit and become a resident. That's going to be a huge transition, and I want to make sure that I am becoming the best resident I can be. So I'll probably take a little bit of a break and then start doing research shortly after that. But I'll be doing research probably for the rest of my life because I'll likely be in academia. But I think that it's really important to establish yourself as a resident first, because you are a physician. After you get your MD, like, that's it, right? Like, you start to practice. And so I'll probably spend some time getting my footing, really starting to become a doctor, and then start to take on some more research projects.
Yeah, that's fantastic to hear. And we wish all the best for you. I'm sure it'll go wonderfully. And this last question I have for you is a bit more on the sentimental side, but what is the ultimate impact that you want to have with your research?
That's a great question. You know, I think every piece of research that I partake in, I want it to impact patient care somehow. For a lot of my research that I've done so far, it might be pretty far out there. It might be pretty far. For my basic science research, I know that that will probably be a while before it becomes clinically relevant, but I still think it's important. The research that I was doing, I can still see as relevant. For the education research, I'm helping doctors become better doctors. So I am incredibly proud of that. I still get messages today thanking me for Path Elective, or, you know, asking Dr. Mirza and I to talk about it or whatever it is. That's incredibly impactful for me. But I do, you know, the end goal is to help patients. And so trying to get involved with projects that I can see impacting patient care is usually what I'm looking for. And, you know, there are some things that I just find intellectually challenging, and I think that we need to learn more about. But if they're intellectually challenging, it probably does affect patient care. So I always try to link that back. But I'm also intellectually curious, so I do kind of get involved with some of those things as well.
That's a wonderful perspective to have, and thank you for sharing. We very much appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. James, do you have any last comments before we wrap up here?
No, just thank you. I think a lot of people are going to find this helpful.
This is really great. Thank you so much for this.